Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of April 2nd, 2010. Where can you turn for reliable advice on housing? Maybe your textbook from English Lit.
Shakespeare said that when home prices are declining, neither a borrower nor a lender be. Or I think he said that.
Okay, we'll stick to the numbers instead of the stage to evaluate the government's new mortgage relief program. The new healthcare law might seem radical to Americans, but some neighbors to the north get sick just thinking about our system.
Despite President Obama's ambitious reform, the American healthcare system remains an expensive, confusing, and often terrifying place for anyone who came from a country with universal public healthcare.
Plus, a movie download here, unlimited texting there, and pretty soon your technology bills are sky high.
I think if somebody was like, you can have all of this stuff for $700 a month.
There's no way we would ever sign up for that.
Ah, but they did. That story and more coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It's here, it's here, it's here. This week, Apple started shipping and selling the alternately vaunted and reviled iPad. Yet another gadget with the potential to improve our lives. Oh, and drain our wallets, too. First, there's the cost just to buy the thing, minimum $500. And then there's the cost to get unlimited 3G access to the internet, an additional $30 a month. As Brendan Francis Noonan tells us, it's just the latest addition to a whole new generation of bills.
Meet
Melissa McNeely
and
Ryan McNeely.
They're newlyweds, and they live with their two dogs in a charming little house in Los Angeles. Recently, I asked them to do something they've never done before: add up how much they spend a month on staying connected and entertained. Stuff like cable and internet access.
$150 a month.
On-demand movies.
$20 or $30 a month.
iTunes downloads.
$30 a month.
And cell phone bills.
$270.
I know.
You heard correctly. $270. And that's not even a family plan.
We can't afford children because of our phones.
Okay, he's joking about the kid thing. But he's serious when he explains that these bills have simply become part of the cost of living.
What's funny is, like, 2 months ago, we were really tight and we were trying to figure out, like, what we could cut out of our lives. And none of this stuff came up.
The McNeelys are us. Over 200 million Americans are online now. 235 million of us have cell phones. Last month, iTunes sold its 10 billionth song. Then there's the cable bill, movie downloads. It's clear. These new digital bills are here to stay. So, are they worth it?
Gosh, it has never been better to be a consumer of information and telecommunication services.
Andrew Zolli is a consultant who studies trends in culture and technology.
You have this explosion of choice. You have tons of innovation. We're getting a lot more value than we are paying for.
Zolli's referring to how phone calls now cost a fraction of what they used to, and how we now have loads of information at our fingertips. The McNeelys agree.
I work in the fashion industry, so I read fashion blogs constantly, art blogs, and access all of international culture, not just Western culture. It's pretty amazing.
I mean, it also seems like you're paying for, like, this second brain.
True, but it's how we pay for this second brain that makes these bills feel different. The charges sneak up on you. You pay a dollar for a song here, a few dollars for a movie there. You expand your texting plan, get an online subscription or two, and pretty soon it adds up. Last month, the McNeely spent $700.
I think if somebody was like, you can have all of this stuff for $700 a month.
There's no way we would ever sign up for that.
And there's the rub, right?
Andrew Zolli again.
This is the paradox of choice. The upside is you've got millions of choices. You've got more content and more ways of reaching it. The downside of all that wonderful opportunity is that you may end up paying for the same thing a couple of different times, a couple of different ways. And navigating that choice is incredibly complicated.
Not surprisingly, amidst this world of complicated choices, companies have sprung up to help you make these complicated choices. BillShrink and MyValidOS are two of them. They help you analyze your wireless bills. And the iTunes store is loaded with apps like Pennies and Pocket Money that are designed to help you keep track of your budget. But the most helpful saving tool to emerge in this brave new world of instant digotainment everywhere is our own behavior.
At some point, consumers make substitutions.
Ross Rubin is an analyst for the MPD Group, a consumer research firm.
a lot of the spending that we're seeing now on digital goods is coming at the expense of a physical packaged media. And as we see increases in spending on cellular bills, some of that is coming at the expense of landline telecom.
In other words, we're saving money by buying less tangible stuff, like CDs, newspapers, and magazines, as well as getting rid of old technology that isn't working for us. Yet, if the McNeelys are any indication, we're not so much cutting costs as shifting costs.
For some reason, all these things are justified, and I don't know that they should be, because we can't really afford them.
And at the same time, I still don't feel like there's anything on this list that I'm totally comfortable giving up.
And that's how new bills turn into old bills. I'm Brendan Francis Noonan for Marketplace Money.
If you were a student loan reform bill, where would you bury yourself? Well, perhaps there is no better place to hide such an Easter egg than in the massive healthcare reform package. And that's right where you'd find it. The biggest change in the student loan program since 1965 eliminated subsidies for private bank lending to college students. Paul Baskin of the Chronicle of Higher Education is here with some details. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
What role will banks now play in the student loan industry?
Well, they won't play as big a role as they have been playing. What the process was that a bank would get a subsidy from the federal government to issue a loan. Now the federal government's simply going to give the money directly to the college and to the student. But the banks will be the ones to handle the paperwork, make sure the students pay back the loans on time. So those that will remain in the system will have a fairly substantial role still.
So they'll basically be servicing the loan then?
Yes. Yes, they'll be servicing the loan, which is what they've been doing all along under their current system. The main difference now is that they won't hold ownership of the loans, at least the loans that are federally subsidized. There's a limit on how much you can borrow under the federal system, and in a lot of cases, it's not enough to cover your cost of college, especially at a private college.
So let's go now to what this means for students past and present. And I'd like to actually start with a question that we're getting from lots of listeners who already have government-subsidized loans. Does this change anything for them?
Basically, no, it doesn't. I mean, for a student who's remaining in school and continuing forward, then it will change what they might pay in the future. But as far as what they've already taken out for loans and the way they're doing it, no, it doesn't change anything.
The other question that we're getting from a lot of folks is that they have heard that the income-based repayment plan is going to change from you have to pay 15% of your income down to 10%. When does that take effect and for whom?
Well, it will take effect immediately, but again, it's for students going forward. And if you've already taken a loan, that doesn't apply to you. But it cuts back both the percentage of your income that you have to pay back and the length of time that you have to pay it from 25 years down to 20 years before it gets forgiven entirely. And this is on a basis basically for students who take low-paying, low-income jobs after they graduate from college.
Let's move on to Pell Grants. Does this in any way change eligibility for those grants?
Eligibility is a very complicated thing for a Pell Grant. So the answer on one level is yes, but mainly what it's doing here is putting more money into the Pell Grant system so that the eligibility or the number of students who can be covered by it and the amount of money that they get will go up.
And let's talk about that amount. How much will the Pell Grant go up over the next several years?
The maximum Pell Grant for the coming school year is $5,550. That same level will stay steady for 2 years, then it will go up by the rate of inflation after that for the following 5 years. So the estimate is that it will get somewhere close to about $6,000 by the end of the 10-year time frame.
That increase really doesn't help much in the grand scheme of things, does it? I mean, it certainly doesn't keep up with the inflation of college costs.
Absolutely does not keep up. The rate of inflation in the cost of going to college has been going up beyond the rate of regular inflation. But that's been the case for decades now in the Pell Grant program, that it has barely, or if at all, kept up with the rate of inflation in the general economy, to say nothing of keeping up with the real inflation in the cost of college.
So can you give us kind of an overall sense of what this bill does for students who are hoping to go to college?
I think it's probably a very classic glass half full, glass half empty thing. One big area that got cut out was community colleges. We're supposed to get about $10 billion. They ended up with $2 billion. that was actually a big centerpiece of the Obama administration's plans for getting a lot more U.S. students into college was by expanding the community colleges. There was also some money for lowering interest rates on these loans. That got cut out. There was some money actually for early childhood education. That got cut out as well. So what really had hoped to be a real windfall for education and higher education in particular from this bill has really turned out to just be a lot of money for programs that Congress has been funding all along at roughly the same pace.
Paul Baskin writes for the Chronicle of Higher Education, and we've been talking about the student loan reforms that passed along with the health bill a couple of weeks ago. Thanks so much for helping us out.
Thank you very much.
And now to a few of your letters. Last week, we devoted two-thirds of the show to the health care reform law. Albert Chen hears us here in Los Angeles. He wished we'd been more critical of the fact that if you choose to go without insurance, you'll be charged a fee.
You spend no time discussing whether or not forcing someone to buy health insurance is a proper government function. The government is usually in the business of prohibiting certain acts, like crimes. In this case, it is compelling you to do something and making it a crime if you don't do it.
Robert Kirchhoff of Olympia, Washington, had a different take on those who decide to go without.
I assume that they would be willing to sign an affidavit absolving any hospital emergency room from treating them if they're ever in an accident or have an emergency of some kind.
Also on last week's show, Sean Cole profiled the actor who plays the main musician in those FreeCreditReport.com commercials.
They say a man should always dress for the job he wants. So why am I dressed up like a pirate in this restaurant?
It's all because... Turns out he's got a behind-the-music backstory, and he's Canadian. Casey Chappell of Colchester, Vermont, loved the piece.
In the past, I've gone so far as to switch channels when these ads came on. Now I will leave them on, with the sound muted, to study this newly interesting character so overwhelmed by unwanted attention from the States. Love it when my mind is changed so dramatically.
The need for dramatic change brought us the story of 26-year-old Christine, a listener from Boise. We did something of a money makeover for her during a recent call-in segment. Many of you wrote in with encouraging words for Christine. But Colleen Tapalia, who hears us in Albany, New York, took issue with our characterization of Christine's problems.
I felt that the story portrayed her as an almost tragic figure rising above life's indignities. She has struggled and turned things around for herself, but let's face it, she seems to have had many advantages that a lot of people lack.
And finally, we'll try not to break our arm patting ourselves on the back, but when listener Kevin Cash, yes, Cash, called in from Brighton, Massachusetts after hearing our recent tax segment, we had to cash in.
Similar to your caller last week, you got us an extra $800 back on our taxes. We figured we should combine that with one of your other stories and tip you for the service. 20%, of course. Hopefully everyone else who got extra money back will tip you also.
To send us your tips, dollar-denominated or otherwise, go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. Actually, send your monetary tips to your local public radio station. Coming up, we answer more of your questions about the new healthcare law and hear from someone who thinks he's still better off as a Canadian.
Before moving to the U.S., I'd never seen a doctor's bill in my life, had never had to receive permission for a procedure, and the only times I've taken out my wallet in a hospital were to buy flowers for someone I was visiting.
That's coming up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We've had a couple of weeks now to digest the big health care bill. Hard to imagine, but it was even longer than the insurance forms you have to fill out in the doctor's waiting room. The biggest question for everyone, of course, is what does it mean for me? So we're going to tackle a couple of those questions. And here with me to do that is David Lazarus, personal finance columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Hi, David.
Hi.
So with that question in mind, what does it mean for me? We have talked on this program before about the fact that you're a diabetic.
Type 1.
I remember when, you know, when we had you on the show right after your diagnosis, and you really talked about how much this was affecting broader life decisions that you could or couldn't make because suddenly you have a pre-existing condition.
Well, in a sense, it's kind of like suddenly being shackled to something because for many people, you think, oh, well, if I don't like my job, I can just go somewhere else. If
right.
I'm not happy in this city, I'll just go somewhere else. And suddenly it becomes a little more complicated. For example, my health coverage is crucial. I'm part of a group plan through my employer. Thank you, employer. And that is a key thing in terms of being able to meet these fixed expenses. And they can run into thousands of dollars a year. And that's even for someone like me who manages very well. So God forbid I actually have a complication where I start looking at some serious coin.
Right.
So that's a factor. And any sort of job issue is also going to have to involve, will I get a better plan? Will there even be a plan? Would you be able to find similar support elsewhere? So yeah, there's personal stuff that you would apply, but nothing is insurmountable.
Well, in the meantime, let's go to the phones and someone with firsthand experience in the issues that patients face when they don't have health insurance. Celeste is with us from Birmingham, Alabama. And you are a nurse, correct?
Yes, I am.
And do you have a specialty?
Yeah, I provide anesthesia, so I'm a nurse anesthetist.
Well, if you are someone who is this deep into the healthcare system, I wonder if it's any easier for you to navigate it than it is for the rest of us.
I don't think so.
No?
I mean, I definitely have, you know, some amount of knowledge. When I look at policies for myself out there, you know, it is probably easier for me to understand some of the details, but at the same time, I still have to, you know, end up calling someone up and asking questions and sometimes come away shaking my head saying, I think I got it. I think I'm not going to be bankrupt at the end of it.
So you are just like the rest of us then.
Yes.
Well, Celeste, presumably you are insured there at your hospital. So what's your question for us?
Oh, well, I'll actually be leaving this job and going out to California to take a different one. And my different one is a 1099 employee, so I will be contracted. I will receive, of course, a large sum of money, in which case I then have to provide my own benefits, including health insurance. So for me, it's a lot of nervousness going into, you know, this open market, which ironically I was already anticipating before the bill was passed. And then now that the bill's passed, you know, I have this nervousness about, oh my gosh, are these rates just going to absolutely soar? Will policies, you know, somehow cost more but offer less, you know, now that I do have to go out there?
Well, David, have you read all 2,400 pages?
Yes, I have. And I'm also waiting for the movie version, of course.
Well, this really is, I mean, her situation is a lot of why this bill came to be, because, you know, she is going to be without an employer plan. I know that there are a bunch of different timelines that apply to all of this. But so, Celeste, when will you be making this move?
Starting May 1st.
Okay. So, David, I think the Department of Health and Human Services has, what, 3 months to come up with the high-risk pool?
Yes. And you know, Celeste isn't going to be going that way because she doesn't sound like she's got pre-existing conditions. She
right.
doesn't have health problems. Your first thing, Celeste, is can you get access to group coverage? For example, if you come out here and join the California Nurses Association or some other labor organization, you want to look at to see whether there's going to be group coverage available. That's always going to be the cheapest recourse for anybody in the United States.
Is that something you've explored?
You know, actually, even more interesting, because I'm still a resident of Alabama and will still be a property owner in Alabama, I actually, to the best of my knowledge, can purchase insurance still from Alabama. And it actually may be cheaper than California, or at least make more sense than what I read from California. So,
all right. Now, Celeste is raising a really good point, and that is, can you game the system a little bit and have insurance from one state where it might be cheaper while you're residing somewhere else? I think you want to be careful with that. First of all, you might get bogged down in a whole lot of paperwork and a whole lot of loopholes, so you want to see what's there. You also want to see if your insurer in Alabama is licensed to provide coverage in California. There's some questions to whether that might be the case.
Sure.
So she might show up at an emergency room or a doctor's office and find out that the Alabama insurance doesn't apply?
Your worst case scenario here is if she has to go to a specialist and the specialist then says, all right, I can do that, but your Alabama insurance is either going to be far too cumbersome for my office to deal with, or simply they don't cover certain procedures that are licensed and regulated here in California. You're going to get caught in that whole gray bureaucratic paper zone where you do not want to be.
So back to her initial question of kind of what she does now. And There's nothing in this bill right now that helps her right away, right? She has to wait till the 2014 when the state exchanges come in.
Exactly. Right?
Or in the meantime, she gets private insurance.
Or she should be looking perhaps at travel insurance as a bridge. Now, this a lot of people think that's only if you're going to be traveling overseas. But in reality, it can be if you're traveling simply to another state and you will be providing yourself some degree of coverage. Obviously, that's not going to be long-term insurance. It can be a little bit pricey. But just in terms of making sure that you have continuing coverage, that might be something that 'll get you over, say, a one-month hump until you've looked into group coverage out here through your labor union or individual insurance.
Interesting. Will you be in the same line of work when you get here to California?
Sure, I will.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, maybe we'll see you in the hospital then.
I hope not. It would kind of in a weird way be great. I'd love to see you.
All right. Thanks so much for the call.
Yes, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, David, next up we have retiree Fred from Worthington, Ohio. Hi, Fred.
Hello.
How long have you been retiree Fred, and from what did you retire?
I have been retired about 14 months now. And I had a quasi-geek job with a technical scientific information database company.
Quasi-geek, not fully.
You got it. Not fully.
And are you enjoying retirement? Is it everything you expected, or do you miss work?
I liked my work, but I found passions outside of work, and I had the luxury, if I can put it that way, of being one of those vanishing breed who had a defined pension plan at my work. And so,
wow.
My wife and I have been subscribing to the KISS rule for several years, if you know that one.
Keep it simple, Sally.
Stupid. Yeah.
Oh, stupid or Sally.
That's funny. And so we had the means to do it. I mean, we're not living extravagantly, but we're really enjoying life even more than when we spent extravagantly. So,
tell us a little bit about that. What are you doing, perhaps, that could help other people who are trying to simplify their lives?
Well, looking back at it now, we realized that we really didn't need a lot to live on, and we realized some things were important, and then that became formalized in our minds when we learned of a movement called the Simplicity Movement.
Hmm.
It's really about when is enough enough, and when do you not need all the stuff, and you start moving toward relationships and building networks with community and all that.
Did you come to this big realization before you decided to retire?
Yes. We really got passionate with the sustainability movement probably about 4 years ago, and after three nights in a row being up until 1 or 2 in the morning working on this volunteer stuff, I said to my wife, I got to stop this. And she said, stop what? And then, Oh, I can stop working. Can I stop working? Hey, do it. And also, we do have, and this leads into my question, we do have a retiree medical plan that my company has. And my company is self-insured both for active employees and for retirees.
Wow. No wonder you were able to retire.
Yes. Well, there are always buts. And one of the buts is that they have capped that medical insurance premium contribution for retirees.
Ah. And are you on Medicare yet?
I am not. I retired before 65.
Okay. So where is the question here? If you're not on Medicare yet, is your question about the health care bill?
And I want to thank Marketplace Money because they led me to a site which broke things down that if you're this situation, then this is it. If you're that situation, but none of the ifs were my situation.
Well, you know, it sounds like what Fred is kind of worrying about implicitly here is, will his defined benefits be there for him in perpetuity? Do I have that right, Fred?
At least until I get to Medicare.
Yeah, exactly.
And how long is that for you?
A couple years.
A couple years.
I know a lot of people in Fred's position right now who are kind of rolling the dice, hoping that they're going to be able to make it to Medicare before some catastrophic problem sets in. And the real question here is, are his benefits going to persist? And I don't have a solid answer for that, because a lot of these plans have been finding that they don't have the money to go forward. In theory, even if his healthcare plan runs into trouble, mm-hmm. it will still provide some degree of benefit. They'll probably start scaling back the benefits before they just simply cut it off altogether. So what Fred wants to keep in mind is supplemental insurance, a way of perhaps stepping up and finding ways to fill the holes if he doesn't feel he has complete coverage as he makes this sprint to Medicare a few years down the road, or he can just simply hold his breath and hope he gets there.
Okay.
Well, very inspirational. Thanks for sharing that story with us.
Thanks.
Take care. Well, David, next up we have Brett, and he's calling in from Baltimore, Maryland. Brett, what do you do there in Baltimore?
I'm in sales, basically, for home improvements. We do bathrooms and kitchens.
Interesting. I wonder, you know, I've heard both sides of this coin during the recession, that either work for home improvement completely dried up because of the housing bust, or because people weren't moving as often because housing prices were crazy and mortgages were non-existent, that they started doing more renovations. What have you found?
I've actually found that renovations in particular areas have gone up. I think that with general contractors, there's more issues that develop just because they tend to subcontract their work.
So are you finding that more people are doing bathrooms or kitchens?
Well, I love kitchens, but our bathroom company is called Bath Fitter. I don't know if you're familiar with it or not.
Nice plug, though, dude. Nice.
Oh, thank you.
Well,
I had to
nailed
say
it.
It.
Nailed
it. In trouble.
Have prices on renovations come down at all? Because I know my husband and I looked at renovating and putting in a new bathroom a couple of years ago, and we were quoted everything from $40,000 to $80,000 for that.
Oh, I believe that.
Has that come down at all?
No, and because the price isn't always in the in parts have come down, the labor is really where the cost is.
So how much extra would you charge to do a job in, say, Pasadena, California?
Well, you know what? I'd be happy to fly out there. I hear the Four Seasons is a beautiful hotel. As long as you're paying, I'm good.
Because, yeah, Tess works in radio. You know she's rolling in cash.
Public radio, especially.
Thank you.
No, we can just start our own home improvement show, and it would be great.
All right. We're all set, and we'll see you next week.
All right. Seriously, just send me my flight.
Oh, but wait a minute. I believe there was a question somewhere in here, and I believe it was about renovating a car.
Yeah, it's a great little story. My wife's grandmother actually gave us her car, and then we had a little minor snowstorm, and it's my wife who had been telling me she was thinking about getting a new car. She was in a car accident. Luckily enough, everything was okay. She had hit a sidewall, just slipped on some ice. She drove the car home.
Now, I'm going to stop you here because, Brett, it sounds like you're wondering if this was really an accident.
That's exactly what I asked her when she told me.
I hear you, man. I had a similar thing with my wife. You got to give her the benefit of the doubt or you're never going to live it down. There it is.
If mama ain't happy, nobody's happy.
Thank you.
Well, given that there's been an accident, so are you now looking for another car?
Well, since then, we actually took the car to the body shop. It turns out that the car was totaled out.
Uh-oh.
We got about $5,000 back for the car, which I was very pleased with.
All right. So you got $5,000.
Basically, I started looking around at cars, and I'm thinking to myself, wow, how are we going to afford this? We've been just trying to build up a whole savings plan to save up 8 months' worth of expenses.
Yay! Pat on the back for you guys.
Thank you. So the question is how do we afford a car? We know we're going to buy used, and I'm shopping around. And most importantly, I'm thinking, wow, we want to spend no more than $20,000 total. We start looking into home equity line, look at refi.
House's piggy bank? Have we not learned this lesson?
Oh, no. I just investigated. I didn't do anything further. Do not worry.
Well, you called the right people here, Brett. You know, you're going to get some strong and harsh advice on this. First of all, here's one way you might want to look at this, Brett, and that is, in a worst-case scenario, to get a used car, would you rather lose the car or lose your house?
Oh, I'd rather lose the car any day of the week.
There you go.
And that's going to define for you right there your financing. You're going to deal with the dealer on this one and then make it a priority to pay that off as quickly as possible.
You know, it's also, you don't have to do financing through the dealership. Check out your local credit unions. You might be able to get an auto loan through them. Or even from your current bank, you can get actually, auto loan rates right now are very low. Frankly, I don't know that you would do much better with a HELOC rate than you can do with an auto loan right now.
Well, thank you so much for allowing me the opportunity to ask you guys questions and be on the show today.
It is our pleasure.
And we'll see you when you come out and fix our kitchen, so we're good.
Absolutely. I can leave my number and email for you afterwards.
All right. Thanks so much, Brett.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can always write to us. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. David, thanks for making our problems your problems.
Well, this is way too much fun.
It is fun, isn't it?
It is.
And remember to check with a professional before you make any big money decisions. Now, not everybody's a fan of the new healthcare reform. Conservatives have decried it as too much government involvement for too big an expense. Commentator David Sacks is not a fan either. Nice try, he says, but I'll keep my socialism.
Hey there, America. Many of you are slapping yourselves on the back right now, given that healthcare reform is law. Way to go. Now, let me tell you why I'm still going back to Canada for my own healthcare. Until I moved to the U.S. a year and a half ago from Toronto, healthcare coverage was a problem I never had to deal with. Because every resident of Canada gets universal, publicly funded healthcare, we're pretty much covered for everything, no questions asked. Before moving to the U.S., I'd never seen a doctor's bill in my life, had never had to receive permission for a procedure, and the only times I've taken out my wallet in a hospital were to buy flowers. Because I work as a freelance journalist, the cheapest healthcare plan I was able to find in New York cost around $200 a month. But that coverage would only kick in after I racked up some $10,000 in expenses, which I had to pay out of pocket. Let me get this straight, I thought. I'm going to pay more than $2,000 a year for insurance that will cover me only after I've racked up 10 grand in medical bills? It seemed like a pretty poor bargain. Instead, I've done what many Canadians, Europeans, and foreigners living in the United States do. Bought catastrophic coverage for emergency care, and continue to use the system in Canada. I book checkups with my doctor when I visit home, and if I have any tests or things I need checked out by a specialist, I make sure to fly back to Toronto. Pretty much all of my Canadian friends who live in the U.S. keep one foot in the Canadian healthcare system. Even friends of mine with fancy Cadillac healthcare plans from their employers keep their Canadian health insurance active just in case they lose their job or are denied coverage for some unforeseen reason. Despite President Obama's ambitious reform, the American healthcare system remains an expensive, confusing, and often terrifying place for anyone who came from a country with universal public healthcare. Our systems aren't perfect. There are often lines, waiting lists, and moments of frustration. But we know that no matter how sick we get or what job we have, Canada, Europe, or Japan will take care of us. Having that life raft accessible, even if we never use it, is a reassurance that's pretty tough to give up.
David Sacks is a New York-based writer. Your thoughts? Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. There's helping someone out. And then there's helping them deal with something as complicated as a home loan modification. All those forms to fill out, spreadsheets, endless phone calls.
It's like a Jackson Pollock painting. Just everywhere, just chaos.
Hear how one attorney prevailed next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. You didn't think we'd get through a whole hour without talking about housing, did you? Well, this week, the Case-Shiller Index delivered a sliver of optimism. Home prices rose by 0.33% in January, in large part thanks to a bump here in California. That news comes on the heels of an effort by the Obama administration to help more folks stay in their homes. But there is still the question of whether any of this means much. For some answers, we turn to Ed Lehmer, director of the UCLA Anderson Forecast. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
First, let me ask you a question that I'm asking just about every housing expert that we bring on the show. Where do you think the market is right now? Is it in recovery? Is it still dropping?
I think that there has been a stabilization. There hasn't been significant appreciation. This market isn't going to get healthy again until we get the buyers back. It's a chicken and egg problem because the buyers are not going to come back until they're confident that home prices are going to stabilize.
Or at the very least, not go down.
Yeah. Normally, if you get a sale, a lower price, people will rush out and buy more. But when it comes to homes, when the prices fall, buyers are thinking, whoa, I think maybe another price cut could be coming around the corner here, and nobody wants to buy that property. And the lender doesn't want to make a loan on it. And Shakespeare said that when home prices are declining, neither a borrower nor a lender be. Or I think he said that.
Yes, I'm sure he was referring to the housing market. Well, there have been all kinds of efforts to get the housing market going again, and none of them really seem to have had much traction. What are your thoughts on this latest plan to reduce principal on mortgage payments for folks who are underwater?
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about this because we qualified individuals who don't really belong in homes.
They couldn't afford the mortgage.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the right program is not to try to desperately hold those people into homes, but rather to encourage them to become renters and facilitate the process by which these homes are turned from owner-occupied homes into rental units.
You know, part of the concern recently has been about adjustable rate mortgages. You look at a lot of folks who took out, say, a 5-1 ARM back in 2005 or a 3-1 back in 07. Now it's set to adjust, and the theory is it's going to create a lot more homeowners who can't afford the mortgage. But so far, that's not happening, right?
Yeah. I mean, Ben Bernanke has been very kind to those homeowners by giving us these incredibly low interest rates that are the base against which the adjustable mortgages adjust. That's likely to exist for some time, but not that long. Homeowners who have mortgages that are these adjustables need to start thinking about what's the right time to lock in a longer-term mortgage.
Yeah, I guess it's just hard to make yourself do that because right now your mortgage rate might actually be dropping.
Yeah, it's very seductive. That's what got us in trouble in 2004 and 2005. The teaser rates didn't come from Wall Street. They really came from Washington, D.C. and the Federal Reserve.
Hmm. And finally, you know, this past week, the Federal Reserve stopped buying mortgage-backed securities from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Give us a sense of why that is important and what it means for folks who are in the housing market.
Well, going back to Shakespeare again, no one wants to be a lender for the home prices that are declining or potentially declining. Federal Reserve wisely recognized that problem and became a lender, in effect, by buying these mortgage-backed securities, hoping, I suppose, that the market would become regular again. I think there's some considerable risk in the short run that the absence of that Federal Reserve support is going to raise interest rates.
On mortgages.
On mortgages, and possibly discourage people from buying homes. But the thing to understand is that nobody's buying a home unless they have some feeling of urgency, that if I don't get it now, I'm not going to get it. And that urgency comes because you think home prices are going to go up, but it can also come because you think mortgage rates are going to go up. So it's not crystal clear what the threat of increased mortgage rates will do to the housing market.
Ed Lehmer is director of the UCLA Anderson Forecast, and we've been talking about the latest in the housing crisis. Thanks so much for your help.
Thank you very much.
Millions of people are seeking those mortgage modifications we mentioned, but fewer than 200,000 have gotten one through the government's Home Affordable Mortgage Program. That is one massive backlog and the source of serious confusion and intimidation for homeowners. So one troubled Sacramento, California family decided to seek professional help. But the person they turned to wasn't exactly an expert in real estate law. In fact, he didn't have much legal experience at all. Wajahat Ali was a newly licensed attorney, and he wrote about his efforts in a recent issue of Panorama magazine. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
You weren't exactly a bankruptcy and home loan expert, right? I mean, at one point you called Google your legal assistant.
Yeah, Google is a fascinating legal assistant, which is also very free. So thank you, Google. But no, I was an unemployed recent law graduate, pretty much a John Grisham cliche. And not at all a specialist in any term of the word.
How much did you know about bankruptcy law and home loans?
I learned as I went along, and I had basically 6 months before taking this case been devouring all information I could. So it was enough where I could talk to a client and explain how the system worked, but I had no idea it was this insane and intricate and essentially like ramming your head against the wall when trying to get a loan modification.
Tell us about what it was like. Well, when you first met with the family, they had 2 days before the foreclosure took effect. Talk us through what you did.
All right, so family comes. You got 2.5 days. I'm like, you got a notice of default? They said, no, we have the foreclosure sale. I'm like, fantastic. 2.5 days left. It's going to be sold. I said, you got to go to a paralegal and get a bankruptcy filing. The reason for that is if you file for bankruptcy, an emergency filing, you get an automatic 15-day extension, which a lot of people don't know. Secondly, I had to create the loan modification package in 2 days. So I'm talking about
why they've lost income, create essentially an Excel sheet with their finances, create my legal demand letter, review their documents. And the whole time, there, you know, a lot of people don't know there's no direct line for attorneys. You wish there was. So we go through the same automated machine that you guys do. We have to listen to the same terrible elevator music. And then, you know, you just go around like it's like a Jackson Pollock painting. It's just everywhere. It's just chaos.
I think that's what really struck me about this story was you really lay out how difficult it is, not just for a homeowner, but for someone who is, you know, trained in law to navigate this minefield that is home loan modifications. I mean, you went through phone tree after phone tree, person after person, people who didn't know even what you were talking about, people who said, you know, well, fax me this, and oh, but I didn't get your fax. I mean, at some point, weren't you just ready to give up?
You know, yes. You sit there exasperated, angry, frustrated, and because you're a young attorney, you're always terrified about losing your bar license. Mm. And especially when it comes to loan modifications, because you keep hearing about all these shady loan mod people. So because they gave me their money and because they entrusted me and because it was a family of five and because I met them and because I knew how much this house meant to them and because I know how much a house means to a family, you know, I knew I couldn't give up because a family is literally depending on you as their last hope.
You talk about the surprise that you felt when one of the bank reps told you that that the bank stalls these things on purpose until the very last minute. And I guess the surprise really comes from the fact that you'd think they'd want to come to some resolution where they're getting money from a borrower, right? But that doesn't seem to enter into the equation.
Yeah, that's the thing. What people don't realize is everyone now says, okay, corporate evil, you know, these guys are just terrible people. They're, you know, they have horrible intentions. That might or might not be true. But what really trumps at the end is the fact that they're very incompetent. No one really knows what's happening. You know, this guy, pretty much who I talked to, admitted to me that the bank does not look at your file until the 3-day mark. So if you have a notice of default or you got a trustee sale date and the trustee sale date's in, you know, in 3 weeks, you think, okay, well, let me get the ball started, mm-hmm. make your life easy, get all the paperwork, you know, just to make sure everything's done early.
But they told you to wait until 3 days before the foreclosure date.
Yeah, they're like, nah, just wait 3 days before the foreclosure date.
I wonder, do you think that this was more about persistence or expertise?
My particular case, like I claim in the article, it's just straight sheer persistence and luck and, you know, prayers, I guess. The fact that I did the research and the fact that I found out a few strategic tips and used them and employed them in a way which was convincing made the best use of, I guess, my relentlessness and my law degree. And the fact that I'm just crazy.
Well, that craziness certainly got you somewhere. You finally got a reprieve for this family through the government's Home Affordable Modification Program. What would you tell homeowners who are in a similar situation and who perhaps don't have the funds to hire an attorney?
What I would say is have good counsel. If not even an attorney, you know, there's a lot of nonprofit agencies right now. Be honest with yourselves. Your house does not define you. You know, having a house or not having a house will not make you any more or less of an American. It's okay to let go of that toxic asset, rent. If, however, you think you can make it, then you know what? Try your best. Talk to people like me and other people, get free resources, and fight on your own.
Well, Mr. Ali, congratulations on what I suppose is an early success. I know it's not over yet for you, but thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
And a little late-breaking news, the family is heading into final negotiations with Wells Fargo to make their modification permanent. Got your 401k match back yet? After scaling back thanks to the Great Recession, Fidelity says many companies are reinstating the match, or at least planning to over the next year. It surveyed employers that use Fidelity to manage their retirement plans. Retirement is just one aspect of our financial lives that involves our workplace. There's also healthcare and, of course, the paycheck. But at least one business owner in Detroit is going even further in helping his workers with their money management. From Michigan Radio, Sarah Hewlett explains.
Matt Bergstrom owns Thornton and Grooms. It's a plumbing and mechanical business in suburban Detroit. It has just over 40 employees. As Michigan's economy sagged under the recession and slumping auto industry, Bergstrom noticed his employees were stressed out over the state of their personal finances, and that stress was starting to affect how they did their jobs.
Our guys and the gals that work for us have to be on every day because they're in front of the customer, whether they're on the phone or whether they're out talking to Mr. or Mrs. Homeowner. And if you've got that stress of a financial burden, it makes it difficult to be able to listen and hear what the needs of the customer are.
So Bergstrom made a deal with his employees. Attend at least 10 weeks of a 13-week course on how to manage household finances, and he'd cover the cost of the class, $165 per employee. More than half his workers and some of their spouses took him up on the offer. On a recent Thursday night, about 20 employees of Thornton & Grooms gather at the site of a former heating and cooling business. The building, like many in this industrial neighborhood, sports a large for lease sign out front. Inside, Bergstrom's employees settle into folding chairs and flip through their workbooks to find tonight's lesson.
Please welcome nationally syndicated radio host and New York Times best-selling author, Dave Ramsey.
The classes are essentially instructional DVDs from personal finance guru Dave Ramsey. They cover topics ranging from saving and budgeting to reducing debt and refinancing mortgages. Tonight's topic, investing.
Welcome to one of my favorite lessons in Financial Peace University. We're going to have a good time learning about something that matters. Open your books to Of Mice and Mutual Funds.
After the DVD, people break into small groups to talk about their own experiences. Matt Bergstrom facilitates the discussion.
Anybody have anything at the table that stuck out?
I think as far as investing goes, I think most of us are just scared because we don't know anything about it. You know, it's like we were talking about our 401ks. A lot of us, I don't even think really know where our money is at in our 401ks.
Several of Bergstrom's employees say the same thing. Investing is intimidating. They don't understand how to do it. One person says he doesn't know where you'd even go to buy into a mutual fund. All our questions, Bergstrom is happy his workers are getting answered.
I look at many of our employees as they almost feel like family. You feel almost a pain for them as they're going through a financial crisis.
Among those taking the class are Dan Prover and his wife, Michelle. They live in a compact brick ranch house in Livonia, Michigan, with their two daughters and two dogs. Dan supervises the plumbers at Thornton and Grooms. He was all for the class, but Michelle was skeptical at first.
Well, I think right away I was,
let's do it. I was more like, you know, what's he going to do for us? We read the books, we read the magazines that tell you you have to save. You know, it's hard. And I just thought it was another scam, to be honest with you.
In the end, the Provers decided to take the course because they'd been spending beyond their means and had more credit card debt than they wanted. The couple say they now realize financial management all starts with budgeting, something they'd never really done before.
It was just, you know, spend. If it was there to use.
We did have a budget, but what our budget consisted of was basic bills that came in through the mail.
Now the Provers budget for everything, from the dog food to what goes in their daughter's lunches. That means fewer impulse buys. It means less eating out. And it means Dan will probably not be replacing the missing hubcaps on his car anytime soon. It also means they know exactly where their money's going. And that's something both Dan and Michelle say is a welcome change. Michelle says in the past, her biggest fights with Dan were about grocery shopping.
That I'm spending too much, that I can't believe you're going to the store again.
And she says those disputes expose deeper feelings about equity in her marriage.
Especially for me being a stay-at-home mom, I feel sometimes like I felt this, he didn't feel it, but that was like his money. So when he brought it home and I, you know, I'm like, well, we need this and this and this and this, and I felt bad about that, you know.
Michelle says there's a lot less to feel bad about now that she and Dan are more upfront about their household finances.
We seem a little happier. I mean, we are happy, but I mean, I think with the budget now in place and money, we talk about money more. We just don't push it under the rug. But you know, we're both involved in the bills, and we know what's going in and out, and so it helps out.
Since they started the class, the Provers have cut up all but one of their credit cards. And Dan says he plans to get rid of that one, too, once they've saved up 3 to 6 months' salary. Provers' boss, Matt Bergstrom, says based on the conversations he's hearing at work, he thinks a lot of them are getting their finances in shape.
It's pretty neat around here to hear people talk about, hey, I'm not using credit cards anymore, I cut up my credit cards, or, you know, I'm paying down this debt or I've gotten that debt handled.
Bergstrom says at least one employee who opted not to take the class now wishes he had. Bergstrom suspects that employee isn't the only one with regrets, so he's planning to offer the course again later this year. In Livonia, Michigan, I'm Sarah Hewlett for Marketplace Money.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, it's April. Do you know where your W-2s and 1040s are? Maybe it helps to think of tax time as your annual money checkup.
You add it all up, look down at the bottom, and you owe something or they owe you. It's one or the other.
And isn't that what our financial lives boil down to? Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Tro. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments. Recent tax law changes could mean new opportunities to save for retirement. You can talk to your financial advisor and get the latest news and insights at RothIRAblog.com.
American Public Media.